We are now beginning the 29th chapter of Ezekiel, and just as the last three chapters were prophecies against Tyre primarily, the next four chapters are going to be prophecies against Egypt primarily. These prophecies were given at five different dates. The first one that we're ready to start now is in the 10th year of the captivity, which would be somewhere around 587 B.C. The next one will be in the 27th year of the captivity. The next two after that will be in the 11th year of the captivity. And the last one will be in the 12th year of the captivity. So beginning with the first verse of chapter 29, in the 10th year, in the 10th month, in the 12th day of the month, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying. So here, as we mentioned, this is in about 587 B.C., this is given to Ezekiel while Jerusalem is still under siege by the Babylonians. And these prophecies against Egypt seem to be in sequence happening shortly after the downfall of Tyre. So Ezekiel says in this first verse, the word of the Lord came unto me saying, Son of man, set thy face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against all Egypt. So we see the scope of this prophecy now. It is, number one, it's against the Pharaoh of Egypt, and it is against all Egypt. In the case of Tyre, the prophecy started against the people of Tyre, and then it later branched off to include the king of Tyre. Now, this one, against Egypt, begins with the king of Egypt. He's told to prophesy against him, and then it includes that the prophecy is to be against all Egypt. According to history, the king of Egypt at this time was Hophra, H-O-P-H-R-A-H. And this king was an absolute monarch. He was supreme in all ways as far as the kingdom went. And he held himself to be above above God. Held himself to be above all other nations. He had no alliance with any other nation that would make him subservient to them. He owed the people nothing, actually, for he was supreme as a king in every way. So, we can see then how haughty he was, how much pride that he had, and how that this prophecy is directed against those very things. So, in verse 3 he says, Speak and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers, which hath said, My river is mine own, and I have made it for myself. So he's told very plainly here by this prophecy that God is against him. Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt. There's no doubt, no question about to whom this prophecy is directed, and there's also no question about the feelings of God toward this great Pharaoh. God was against him. And this is true, of course, anytime God turns against someone and he openly and absolutely states that he's against them, then they're in for trouble. There's just no way that they're going to be able to extricate themselves from those difficulties as long as they have God to be against them. And that's the case here with this Pharaoh, and we're going to find the reasons later. But in this first statement of God being against Pharaoh, he refers to him as the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers. Now, of course, the great Nile River and its tributaries were the very life of this country of Egypt. And Pharaoh then is depicted here as being a great dragon or a great crocodile. Now, I understand that the Nile River was noted for the fact that it had numerous crocodiles in it. And so he's called here this great dragon that lies in the midst of his rivers. This king then is depicted as a beast like a crocodile that would be found in this river or in the river Nile, and which has said, My river is mine own, and I have made it for myself. Now, not only was this king an absolute monarch, but he considered himself to be above all other things, all other beings. even to the point that he says, "My river is mine own. I made it myself." Now, as we know, we receive our blessings from God, and so it is most unfitting for us to ever ascribe something like this to ourselves. We couldn't make anything like this river. This comes from God. But this king considered that he was so great and so powerful that this river was his, that he'd made it for himself. He owned it, he possessed it, he created it, and consequently then he owed nobody, he owed no being, he owed no God anything for what he was allowed to enjoy here. Now this is against all principles of those who are God-fearing and God-loving people. We must realize that all of our blessings come from God, that we are dependent upon God for these blessings, that God can, just as surely as he gave them to us, he can take them away from us. We are to be continually in a state of thanksgiving to God for these blessings, and we are to try to use them in such a way as to give glory and honor to the God that gave them to us. But this king went against all of this. He said, "My river is mine own. I've made it for myself." We learn in Genesis 47, verse 23, where this people was actually bought by Joseph for the Pharaoh. Then Joseph said unto the people, "Behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land." So this king was certainly a powerful king. Nobody in the land was equal to or above him. And as a matter of fact, according to that scripture there in Genesis, the people had all been bought by this Pharaoh. So he owned the people. They were his true, absolute servants. He could do with them and for them and about them as he pleased. And so he had this feeling, "I am all powerful. I am all self-sufficient. I do not have to depend upon God or any other thing for my being, for my power, for my existence as this king." And so he felt that he was completely independent. No other nation was over him. He wasn't a vassal to any. He wasn't owing anything to anybody else. And as a matter of fact, when he did make promises like to Israel, he didn't have to fulfill those promises, he felt. And so you can see the position this king was in when he makes this statement, "My river is mine own and I've made it for myself." The very opposite of all that we know as God-fearing people. The very opposite of what we today should have as our feeling toward our possessions and toward our condition and our position in life and toward our God. So you can see this king then was really a source of great displeasure to the God and to the principles of God. So he says in verse 4, "But I will put hooks in thy jaws, and I will cause the fish of thy rivers to stick under thy scales, and I will bring thee up out of the midst of thy rivers, and all the fish of thy rivers shall stick under thy scales." So this king then is going to be uprooted from his security, from his place of absolute rule, from this great river that is the life of this nation of Egypt. He's going to be uprooted from it. He said, "I will put hooks in thy jaws and then cause the fish of thy river to stick to thy scales." All those that were faithful to the king, all those that would stay with the king, would stick to him, and so whatever happened to him would also, to that extent, happen to them. And it'd be just like pulling this great crocodile up out of the river, and all the faithful fish, all those that were in favor of doing the will of the crocodile, would stick to him and come up out of the river with him. And as you know, when fish are brought up out of a river, they're in a foreign and hostile environment, and it's hard for them to survive in that condition. And that's what's going to happen here now to the king of Egypt and to all Egypt, that is, the rest of the people in Egypt. Verse 5, "And I will leave thee thrown into the wilderness, thee and all the fish of thy rivers. Thou shalt fall upon the open fields. Thou shalt not be brought together nor gathered. I have given thee for meat to the beasts of the field and to the fowls of the heaven." So we see here the picture that's depicted of this great fish, this great dragon, this crocodile that's brought up out of the rivers, and all the fish that stuck to his scales. He says, I will leave thee thrown into the wilderness, thee and all the fish of thy rivers. And as we mentioned before, this is a very hostile, unnatural environment for fish to be put into, thrown into the wilderness, thrown into the open fields, taken out of the river. And he says, thou shalt not be brought together nor gathered. That is, they're going to be in a scattered state. They can't unite. They can't gain any strength. They can't rally support for this king or for this kingdom. He says, I have given thee for meat to the beasts of the field and to the fowls of the heaven. That is, the other nations round about them now are going to devour them, going to partake of their riches and their wealth and their splendor, going to rob them of their security. And this is going to exist for a certain period of time, which we will learn. And he says in verse 6, and all the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am the Lord, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. Now in this verse he begins to tell why he's going to do this, why he had such a feeling against Egypt that he was going to bring about their downfall, going to bring about their doom. First of all, he states one of the results of this, that all the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am the Lord. That is, they're going to have to understand that this king, this Pharaoh, is not their God. He's not a true God. He is not all-powerful and all-knowing and all-self-sufficient, that he can be brought under to submission by the true and living God. There is another God that is the true God, and Egypt's going to know this. All the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am the Lord. And we've had this repeated over and over again as a result of the punishments, as a result of the great chastisements and persecution that God brings upon people. One of the things that come out of that is that they know then that this is the true God. This is the Lord. They cannot look to themselves or look to some other God and say this is God, because that has so utterly and miserably failed them. But he tells the true reason now that he is bringing about these calamities on Egypt. He says, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. This king of Egypt had made great promises to Israel. And he had encouraged Israel to make a break with the king of Babylonia. He'd encouraged Israel to put themselves into a position that was not very secure by provoking Nebuchadnezzar. Now, of course, this wasn't God's will for them to provoke Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't God's will for them to break their agreement with Babylonia. But the king of Egypt had egged it on, and he'd promised Israel that if they would make this break, if they would rebel against their agreement with Babylonia, that he would help them. And so he'd promised them that he would be something that they could lean upon, that they could turn to him for security, that he'd be a staff. But as we see here, he says that they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. Now, a staff of reed is not very strong. It's standing there straight. It looks like it may give some support, but when you lean upon the reed, it's just going to bend and break, because it's just a stem of a plant that's very flexible and will not support very much weight. So they're called a staff of reed. And this is according to some of the prophecies that we read in Isaiah. For example, in Isaiah 30, verses 6 and 7, Isaiah speaks of this. He says, the burden of the beasts of the south into the land of trouble and anguish, from whence come the young and old lion, the viper and fiery flying serpent. They will carry their riches upon the shoulders of young asses, and their treasures under the bunches upon the bunches of camels, to a people that shall not profit them. For the Egyptians shall help in vain, and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still. So Isaiah is describing the fact that Israel is going to send these burdens of treasures down to Egypt, trying to make some kind of an agreement, trying to get some kind of security from Egypt. They're going to send the burden of the beast of the south, He says they will carry their riches upon the shoulders of young asses and their treasures upon the bunches of camels to a people that shall not profit them. This going into Egypt is not going to help. It's not going to change the fact that they're not obedient to God. It's not going to change the fact that they have a duty to perform to God. And you cannot turn to men or to the things of men for your security, especially when it comes to spiritual matters. And so he says, the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore I've cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still. That is, they're not going to do anything to help you. They make a lot of promises, but they're not going to help. We again have this referred to in Isaiah chapter 36, verse 6. Lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. So that explains very plainly there that Egypt would not live up to their agreements. They would not live up to their promises. They could not be trusted. They could not be depended upon. They were just like a staff of reed that would break. And he says in Isaiah 36:6 that if a man lean upon it, it will break and go into his hand. It would break into a splinter and just pierce into his hand and do him more damage than it could ever do him good in that way. So that's what Ezekiel is alluding to here. He says, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. Verse 7, when they took hold of thee by thy hand, thou didst break and rend all their shoulder. Now that is when they reached out to grab a hold of this reed for some support. They took hold of it by the hand, then it broke and it did rend all their shoulder. That is, it tore the shoulder loose from the body. Another translation limits this to having to tearing the hand. So it's just like you reached out to grab a hold of something for some support, and when you leaned on it, it broke, then it caused that part of your body then to be injured. Then he further says, and when they leaned upon thee, thou breakest and madest all their loins to be at a stand. That is, the loins, or the legs, were involved also when this reed broke. And this word for stand is translated by some of the translations as quake. Did make the legs to quake. You offered no support. Or rather, you gave no support. They offered a lot of support, but they didn't live up to their promises. Now, I would like to explain a couple of things here. First of all, it was not God's will for Israel to turn to Egypt. He didn't want them to turn to Egypt. He wasn't in favor of Egypt giving them support. He wasn't going to allow, as a matter of fact, Egypt to take the place of the promises and the duties that Israel was to carry out. However, it doesn't change the fact that Egypt and Israel made a bargain. They negotiated. Israel did send gifts down. They did send the burdens down, the treasures down. They did have an agreement with Egypt. And so simply because it wasn't God's will for Israel to depend upon Egypt did not change the fact that Egypt reneged on its obligations. Now, and so God held this against Egypt. Egypt had made an agreement, had made an obligation with God's people. And they backed out of it. They failed. They stood still. They were a reed that broke when it was leaned upon, and that did damage to Israel as a result of their having broken. And so it doesn't matter then that it wasn't God's will for Israel to turn to Egypt. It doesn't change the fact that Egypt still made an agreement and failed to keep their agreement, and God held that against Egypt. And so we should take that as a lesson for us today. When we make an agreement, if it's an open and bona fide agreement, then we have an obligation to fulfill that agreement. We cannot say, well, some other circumstances have arisen now that's canceled out our obligation. No, we made an agreement, we have an obligation, and we are to carry out our part of it. This is just one of the principles that God expects His people to live by. And of course, it's one of the great principles that the world's going to be judged by. It's one of the great rules or standards by which men are going to have to give an account. And so, let's honor our agreements. For example, if we owe somebody some money, even though this person should turn out to be a vile, ungodly type person, it does not change the fact that we made an agreement, we owe them a debt, and we're to fulfill our part of the agreement. This especially applies to the case of our obligation to our parents. It matters not what kind of persons our parents are, how much they may be unacceptable to God, we owe them the duty of giving them honor. That's a debt that we have. It's an obligation that we have. We cannot cancel it out. It's there, and it's for us then to live up to our part of it. And I'd like to point out that this principle is even more compounded when somebody's dealing with the people of God. When you're dealing with the children of God, and you defraud them, you do something to bring about harm to them, then God takes an especially hard view of this. God does not let this go by, and you will have to give an account, you will have to give an answer, you will have to reckon with God for having done despite to His people. So you're on very dangerous ground any time that you're abusing or not living up to your obligation to one of God's people. And those of us in the church should realize that we have a very special protection given to us by God in this regard. Those who would oppose us in the things that they have no reason to oppose us in are going to be defeated by God, and God will come to our aid and to our protection. We should also remember this principle very muchly too when we're dealing with fellow members of the church. If we abuse a child of God, then we're putting ourselves in very special jeopardy. Well, we're going to close at that point. Till next time then, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.